Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Welcome to Stagecraft, Variety's theater podcast, bringing you backstage and behind the scenes with the stars and creators of the hottest shows on Broadway, off-Broadway, and beyond. I'm your host, Gordon Cox. On this episode of Stagecraft, I'm talking to Michael R. Jackson. He's the writer-composer behind A Strange Loop, which last month became one of only a very few musicals to ever win the Pulitzer Prize. That was after Strange Loop became a buzzy off-Broadway hit in its world premiere at Playwrights Horizons last year, and has since gone on to win a number of awards, including the New York Drama Critics Circle Award for Best Musical. It's a show we'll all be seeing again, even if the pandemic has hit pause on a DC production that was aiming for Broadway. And in the meantime, Jackson has other work taking the spotlight, including Teeth, a musical he co-wrote based on the 2007 horror film, and getting a digital showcase from the New York Theater Barn June 10th. Jackson's in the virtual studio with me to tell us about what he's working on these days, how he's celebrated his big wins, and why he's only just begun to embrace being called a composer. Hey, Michael. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Gordon.
Yeah. So what do you do when you found out you've won the Pulitzer Prize at a time where you can't celebrate with your friends and you basically can't leave the apartment? How did you celebrate?
The only thing I could do to celebrate was go for a walk. And I listened to...
That's a big deal these days.
It is. I went for a walk and I'd listened to Luther Vandross, Never Too Much, and Chaka Khan's Through the Fire.
Why those songs in particular?
Just, I don't know. And what was some other Chaka Khan songs as well. But like there was something about the two of their voices that felt like a celebration to me. So Luther Vandross and Chaka Khan helped me celebrate on my walk through Washington Heights in New York.
And the Pulitzer is, of course, a great big prize, and it's one of several that A Strange Loop has been winning this spring, all the award season. Strange Loop was, you know, ran last summer, but as part of the award season now, such as it is. That's a lot of attention. How is that exciting for you? Is it scare you at all? How do you take it all in?
It's been really nice. I have to say, like, you know, I've said this in many interviews at this point, but like, I feel like I've been Sam Beckett from that TV show Quantum Leap. I just feel like I keep transporting back and forth through all these different, you know, realities of like COVID-19, hellscape, world on fire. And then, oh my God, you won like a Drama Critics Circle Award. Right. COVID-19, city on fire. Oh my God, here's a Pulitzer. You know, like, and so like, I'm just constantly like going back and forth. It's like very schizophrenic and trippy. But it's also like, it's very affirming and it makes me feel good. Like, and especially because so many people in the theater community have sort of, they feel like they've won by virtue of the fact that A Strange Loop won, which is because it's not the piece that you normally think of as winning a Pulitzer, I guess. And like, and me watching people celebrate that in this time of great uncertainty, it makes me feel like warm and hopeful and just good. So it's been a really great experience so far. Yeah. I mean, it's also been utterly insane because like my emails are like exploding every day and like text messages and like there's now a lot to do in the aftermath of the Pulitzer.
Can you give me some examples?
I mean, just like people have reached out to me about wanting to work on projects. I'm recording quite a lot of podcasts.
Yes, yes. I'm contributing to this. I apologize.
No, it's good. Prior to all of this, I was just sitting, you know, in my bed watching Designing Women every day.
Right.
It's good. Like, it gets me up. It reminds me of my purpose. Right. And so I'm like writing and getting ready for various little projects and things like that. So
yeah,
it's been great, but crazy.
And Strange Loop takes its title from a Liz Phair song, and you've cited Liz Phair as an influence on the show and on yourself.
Takes place in, yeah.
How? Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. It takes its place, it comes from two places. Liz Phair's Strange Loop is one, and Douglas Hofstadter's I Am a Strange Loop is the other.
Right, right, yeah.
Yes.
And has Liz Phair seen the show? And does she? Do you know yet?
She has not seen the show because when it was first going around, she had just finished a tour. I had seen her in concert like a couple of months before, and because she did Celebrate Brooklyn this past summer,
right in the park.
Then,
yeah,
yeah, and then she went, and she lives in California, and she like got caught wind of the show, and she was aware of it, and she knew about me a little bit. But like, I was like, there's no way she's going to like fly all the way back from California. She just left here to come see an off-Broadway musical. So she hasn't seen it, but she's aware of it. She's like tweeted in support of it. I got to meet her because then she did another tour, in New Jersey, like a couple months ago. And I got to go backstage and meet her and talk to her. And so it was really wonderful. So like, he's been a supporter, but he hasn't seen the show yet. So hopefully in the new world, maybe the show will get done in California and she can see it, or maybe it'll have another life in New York and she can come and see it, but she hasn't seen it yet.
Right. And another person whose work comes up in the show pretty frequently is Tyler Perry, who's maybe, maybe can we say he's red for filth in the show? But does he... Go ahead.
Well, it's interesting because Tyler Perry called me last week.
That was my question. What has he heard or seen?
He has not seen the show. He's heard about it. And now he has the cast album.
Great.
Which he purchased after talking to me. I guess you could say he's read for filth in the show. But what is also true is that the character who is reading him for filth also reads himself for filth.
Yeah.
Through Tyler Perry. So like, it's a complicated critique of Tyler Perry's work, but also of like sort of larger issues around that.
Right, right, yeah. And not many musicals win the Pulitzer, which means A Strange Loop is one of a pretty small group of shows. We're talking
it's just been 10.
It's 10, shows. Right? Yeah, so it's like Hamilton and Rent and Sunday in the Park.
And A Chorus Line. I like to keep bringing that up just because that just blows my mind that I get to be near anything as exquisite and perfect as A Chorus Line.
That was exactly my question, was what of those works is particularly meaningful to you? Why is A Chorus Line that show for you?
A Chorus Line, I have like this interesting relationship with, because it was a show that I actually didn't know like very well as a kid or anything. And I'd always heard about it, but I think like the most I knew about it was like One Singular Sensation. Sure. And I think they used it in like a popcorn commercial. So like that was like my relationship to it. And then like when I was in... After college, I was working a lot of temp jobs, and I remember going to the Virgin Megastore here in New York, may she rest in peace.
Yeah, exactly.
And there was, like, in the bargain bin was, like, the original Broadway cast album of A Chorus Line. I was like, oh, yeah, I've always heard about the show, and I'm a student, and I'm a musical theater, you know, MFA. I should know more about the show. And we studied a little bit in school, but I didn't know the show. And I, like, let me buy this cast album, not listen to it. But then I bought it, and I, like, forgot about it. I didn't listen to it. So then I was working this temp job at this horrible insurance company doing data entry one day, and I was like, I need some new music to listen to while I'm doing this really boring work. And I said, oh, why don't I listen to A Chorus Line? And so I got my then Discman, you know, because I still was doing CDs at that time. Sure. And I'm doing my data entry while listening to the original Broadway cast album of A Chorus Line. And from the moment the music started, like my body just like chills went down like the back of my spine. And then it got to that song, Mother, oh Mother, like, and I just started uncontrollably weeping at my desk while doing data entry, because it was just like the most beautiful and emotional and just touching and like kind of razzy jazzy 70s, you know, we sound like actual human beings and not like auto-tuned, like just everything about it just like plugged in, like just touched me to like the depths of the bottom of my soul, you know?
Yeah.
And, like, and I just, and then it turned out that weekend was the closing weekend of the revival of A Chorus Line. So I like rushed and bought a ticket, and I like went and saw like the very last performance of A Chorus Line on Broadway, the revival. And so it's just a show that I love. I come back to it so often, and it's one of the touchstones for A Strange Loop in terms of like just the structure of it. There's things in A Strange Loop that don't necessarily reference A Chorus Line in a direct way, but like I like when I wrote the opening number for A Strange Loop, it was trying to sort of be my version of something like God, I Hope I Get It. Like, there were aspects of like just how I approached it, the feeling I wanted it, the song to have, that came from like me listening to, you know, that cast album.
Yeah. What are some other musical influences that you're drawing on in Strange Loop?
Company is definitely one. Passing Strange is another. The Bubbly Black Girl Sheds Her Chameleon Skin by Kirsten Childs is another. Those four are like my big touchstones.
And in general for your work, who else do you consider your sort of musical theater kind of influences?
William Finn, Bill Finn, for sure. He was my teacher, and he's someone who I sort of, in terms of writing from the self and writing very personal things, like he's someone who I really look to. Sondheim is someone whose work I like deeply, deeply respect, just because he's a composer who writes like a book writer. And that's something that I've always tried to sort of model my approach after, even though I don't think our music is not the same or anything, but I love his music and I love his lyric writing. And I just love the way he's so in touch with his own point of view, which is something that I've also like worked on over the years, like being really in touch with my own point of view through my writing. There's so many other people, like, you know, people who I just love. I could go on and on.
Have you always been a composer, and has music always been a part of how you imagine yourself as a storyteller?
So yes and no. It took me a long time to embrace the term composer because I don't have any formal composition training. And I learned how to play piano by ear initially. I took a little bit of classical piano, but like I never particularly excelled at it. I'm not a great player. I can play what I can play. I have a really good ear. I have perfect pitch. So those sorts of things help me. And I'm a very musically inclined person. I grew up singing in choirs. I can read music a little bit. So Liz Thayer is like a big influence on A Strange Loop and some of my writing. But Tori Amos is like my original origin story. She's someone whose work I encountered as a teenager, and I wanted to be her. Like, I wanted to write like her. And I used to try to copy writing songs like her as a teenager, but I didn't know how to write lyrics. But musically, a lot of the gestures that, if you listen to my music, there are certain gestures that are overlap with her in lots of ways. And so all of that sort of boiled into, you know, me not knowing how to write lyrics and therefore not being able to write a song as a high schooler, and then going to college and going to playwriting school and then going to grad school for musical theater writing as a book writer and who was learning how to write lyrics. And I learned how to write lyrics, and then once I got a handle of that form, it gave the musical impulses that had been with me since I was a little kid somewhere to go. And so from there, I began writing my own music, even though for my thesis project, I was paired with a composer. But even then, I was just like, I'm just a songwriter. I'm not a composer. To me, composers were fancier and more accomplished and more trained and all of those things. But the more I kept doing it and putting my work up and then starting to integrate that with, you know, book writing, I learned to embrace the title of composer.
Right. And you're a performer as well. Or do you still think of yourself as a performer? You have.
It's interesting because like my initial, as a kid, I did a lot of child acting, and then I like quit the business when I was 13 because I thought I was too ugly to ever be a movie star. And so I thought of myself as a writer. But then once I started, you know, putting songs up in concerts and everything years and years later, the thing I noticed was, I would sometimes give my songs to other people to sing, and like they were fine, but they couldn't quite get in the pocket of what I was writing from like such a personal place, because they would often, some of them would treat what I'd given them as though it was like a musical theater, a capital M, capital T musical theater song. And that just wasn't exactly what I was writing. And so I was like, I learned that I had to do it to sort of, for some of what I was writing, to sort of really communicate the style in a clear way. And it forced me to have to become comfortable presenting my own work over years. And so I'm now at the point where like I always do it if I need to, you know. I mean, I obviously collaborate with actors. I never want to be in any musical that I ever write. Mm. But like when I do like a concert or things, like I always am, I'm happy to like get up there and do it myself. And also, frankly, it's just easier because it's less people to wrangle.
Right. Yeah. And it can be easy to watch A Strange Loop and think, oh, it's an entirely autobiographical piece about, you know, you and your life. But that's not entirely correct. For one thing, you could have been in the show if it was really about you, right?
Tell us about
what the relationship is of the show to autobiography and how you think of it.
So if the only kind of, I think of it as emotionally autobiographical, mm-hmm. and I call it self-referential instead, because mm-hmm. like, while I did draw on personal experience to write it, it's also something that is made, it's constructed, and it's a mix of fact and fiction. So like, for example, you know, I don't know how well you know the show, but like, yep. I did work as an usher at a Broadway musical.
Right.
I did, you know, go to NYU for musical theater writing and playwriting.
Right.
I did go meet like a horrible like white man in Inwood, but like, what's important about all of that are just the way it felt, how it seemed to me as a younger person. I'm 39. Usher, I know I'm like making myself younger already. Yeah. Usher is 26. Right. So like the perspectives in the show are from like a younger person who is also reflecting on himself as a younger person and in the present. So like, because it contains so many, such a multiplicity of perspectives and feelings, and frankly, feelings of self-hatred, it's not, I can't call it autobiographical, because autobiography connotes something that has a really one-to-one representation, and it just isn't that. Like there's things I made up, and there's things that are like quote-unquote true.
Yeah. Has working on the musical, or did working on the musical, or did seeing it on stage help you work through some of your own emotions that inspired or were part of an echo, or were echoed on stage?
Well, honestly, if to the extent to which I was working through any emotions in my own life, that work had already been done, because I couldn't have written the piece unless I had some perspective on it. And that was, I think, part of the reason why it took me as long as it did to write it, because I technically started writing A Strange Loop when I was 21. It started off as a monologue, a thinly veiled personal monologue that I wrote my senior year of college, called Why I Can't Get Work, because I was about to graduate from NYU with a playwriting degree and like lots of student loan debt, and I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. And so I wrote this thinly veiled personal monologue about this young Black gay man walking around New York wondering why life was so terrible. And also reflecting a little bit on like September 11th, because it was like right in the aftermath of that. And that piece then sort of began to evolve over the years as I began to write music and then try to put the music into that monologue. And so it went from the Bush era to like the next Bush era to the Obama era to then being produced in the Trump era, to yeah. both terms of Obama to then being produced in the Trump era. So it just is a piece that just has like a lot of timelines and feelings in it. And that's something that like I would also like to try to remind people.
Yeah.
I'll have more with Michael right after the break. Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater,
SUPS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUPS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUPSmusical.com.
And now, here's more with the writer-composer Michael R. Jackson.
You mentioned that you're enjoying seeing the community that sort of rallied around the show celebrate with you. And, you know, the show has a lot of fans in the theater community. And I think a lot of us were very excited to hear that the show was planning to have a run at Woolly Mammoth in D.C. and ahead of a potential Broadway run. What's the status of that now that everything is sort of paused?
Well, it was originally scheduled to go up in the fall of this year, but it just was announced that we're now looking toward a summer run of next year. And, you know, I have a really amazing commercial producer behind the piece, Barbara Whitman, who, you know, has like a really strong track record of producing shows for Broadway. And so like our hopes are that, you know, we will be able to make that happen once we're unpaused. So, I mean, things are still very much, we're optimistic for when that happens.
Is Strange Loop finished? Are you done working on it?
I'm not. I mean, I'm not making any major changes. I'm not like writing any new songs or anything like that. But like, I didn't get to hit everything that I wanted to do during previews when I was running off Broadway. And so there are some things that I want to tighten up and clarify. Again, not major things, but like just a couple things that I think are important for whatever the next step will be.
Yeah. Assuming the show does reach Broadway at some point, what do you feel like it will mean to you to see it on Broadway in particular?
I almost feel like it'll be like I will have secreted it. you know what I mean?
Because, yeah, like the book's the secret, right? Yes.
Well, because literally the opening number says big black and queer ass American Broadway show.
Right.
And so like I dream about the day when like it opens at, you know, whatever Broadway theater will have us. Mm. And the first time we get to hear the cast sing big black and queer ass American Broadway show on a Broadway stage, that will be a strange loop. The show contains so many strange loops within it already. And that, it feels like that would be like the final one.
Right. Is there anything that makes you particularly...
That would be the final one. Then that would be the penultimate one. The next one would be is when both Tyler Perry and Liz Phair and Scott Rudin are all seated in the same audience together.
Yes. Yes. Scott Rudin also gets mentioned. That's correct. Yes.
He's also aware of the show and he really likes it.
I'm sure. Yeah. Is there anything that makes you trepidatious or hesitant or wary about the idea of the show going to Broadway and, you know, a sort of more stereotypical Broadway audience seeing it?
Well, I guess like that's kind of another strange loop too, because when I was somewhere in the middle of when I was writing it, somewhere between 2001 and 2019, when I was ushering in at The Lion King and Mary Poppins, I saw, that was the first time that I saw like Broadway tourists up close and personal.
Right.
And then I did a stint as a flyer. I flyered for Rock of Ages for a horrible summer.
Oh, yeah.
And like, so I was there on that accursed triangle in this hot summer heat with the Chicago girls and like these crazy scalpers being like, Mamma Mia, Mamma Mia, Mamma Mia, you know? And like, and I saw Broadway tourists up close who were like, it was like they didn't care what it was as long as it was just like a soda. That's what it felt like. And I thought in the midst of all of that, the ushering and the flyering and just that Times Square-ness of it all, I was like, oh, I don't do this. Mm. And so therefore, no one will ever want to see my big black and queer ass American Broadway show. Like, it's not commercial. And so I was like, I'm just going to keep writing it because there's no stakes. No one will ever do it. So right. I'll just write it and make it whatever the fuck I want to make it. Mm-hmm. And so, but then lo and behold, the culture sort of shifts and suddenly people are going to do it. Mm-hmm. And so if I have any trepidations or fears, it's somewhat similar to what I felt before, is that, oh, it won't make money. That people just won't come and see it because it's not quote unquote commercial enough. And yet the culture, especially with conferring the Pulitzer on it, has sort of given it a cultural stamp of approval in mm-hmm. some ways, at least one part of the culture, I guess. And the thing that has always been important to me about A Strange Loop is that it have both, it be as, my mission statement is to make work that is as challenging as it is entertaining. Mm-hmm. And so the thing I have always wanted for it and tried to make happen, and I think we were successful with this at Playwrights Horizons, was making it something that we invited the audience to give a shit. That we were putting something that was both, really, really entertaining, but really thought-provoking and makes you feel. And I just don't see why musicals can't all be like that. It doesn't have to be stupid to be a good time. And so my hope is that if we are able to get to Broadway, that even though it's a piece that is very challenging in a lot of ways, it's also extremely pleasurable, and that pleasure is part of the Broadway experience, certainly the Broadway shows that I have loved. So I don't know. So my trepidation is just that maybe my calculation will be wrong, and that people only want to see musicals that are escapist and don't have a deep thinking or deep feeling behind them.
Right. Yeah.
But we'll see. We'll find out.
And we're going to find out. During this time of pause, some of your other work is starting to show up online. You've got mm-hmm. coming up pretty soon a showcase of a musical you're working on called Teeth online. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so Teeth is a piece that I'm working on with my collaborator, Anna K. Jacobs. We're sharing book, and she's the composer, and I'm the lyricist. Mm-hmm. And it's adapted from the 2007 indie horror comedy film, Teeth, of the same name, by Mitchell Lichtenstein. And it's about a teenage, evangelical Christian teenage girl who discovers she has teeth in her vagina. Mm. And it's a real rip-roaring romp of a show, but also with deeper messages about female agency in it. And so we're doing a little excerpt of it on a show that my friend Joe Barros is hosting.
Yeah. And is there a plan or a timeline for that show, for when we might possibly see it?
We're still in development and looking for people who might be interested. So we're just staying tuned for that.
Yeah. And I know you have another show called, I believe, White Girl in Danger. Do I have that right?
That's right.
And
yes.
Tell me about that.
So I'm working on White Girl in Danger with the Vineyard Theater and the development, and Liliana Blaine Cruz is my director.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's a show that is inspired by / set in the world of Lifetime original movies from the 90s. So right. movies like She Cried No, She Fought Alone, Mother May I Sleep with Danger, and also classic soap operas like All My Children, One Life to Live, etc.
Right.
And it's kind of a really wacky piece that's set in the world of one of those universes called, and it's in a universe called All White. And in All White, there are, so All White, Pine Valley or Landview or whatever. And in All White, there are these All White stories going on that are just white women in all kinds of trouble, and their boyfriends and mothers and all these sorts of things. And then there's also a group of people called the Black Round. And the Black Round are Black characters who are just there to support their all white storyline lives. Yeah. And then one of the Black Round is this girl named Keisha, who decides she's got what it takes to be the protagonist of her own all white story. So she begs the writer of the universe to please make her a protagonist. And he strikes her with lightning. And then her hair slowly begins to turn blonde over the course of the show, as she usurps storylines from her three main rivals Negan, Megan, and Megan, who are the three sort of like have the hottest white all white storylines of all time. So like Megan has he has an eating disorder and like and he's always has to get an A on everything or her mom's gonna kill her. Megan is like a lonely bad girl whose mother is very glamorous, globe-trotting Judith, who ignores her, and therefore he gets into drugs and alcohol and boys. Mm-hmm. And then Negan has like an abusive boyfriend named Zach Paul Gosselaar, who, you know, we think is the killer, because the killer, meanwhile, there's a killer who's killing all these all-white girls and women throughout the town, and so like, there's a whole mystery element of like who's the killer, and once Keisha sort of enters the mix and like her hair starts turning blonde and she starts becoming the center of the story, chaos ensues because there's this black brown girl sort of at the center of this all white story, and the universe kind of reacts to that. Mm-hmm. So it's a very wild, crazy meta theatrical piece that sort of comes from. So prior to my getting into musical theater, I moved to New York to go to NYU because I thought I was going to be a soap opera writer. My dream was to be the head writer of One Life to Live.
Was and that that's your like show?
I had many shows, but that was the one I wanted to write for. And so that I did, like I interned at All My Children. I interned at ABC Daytime.
Oh, wow.
I did a youth marketing consulting job where I got to watch soaps for ABC and tell them what I thought. Like I was like, I was before I got into grad school, I had interviewed to be an executive assistant at CBS Daytime. Like I was like, that was the track I was on. And then I just happened to get in. I didn't get that job. And I got into grad school for musical theater writing, and then my life went into this different direction. But this show, White Girl in Danger, sort of is my attempt to scratch that itch, but also to talk about issues of quote-unquote diversity, equity, and inclusion, and representation on stage, and sort of some feelings I've been having as that conversation has been playing out in, you know, the world over the last couple of years.
Yeah. What else are you working on that we should know about?
I have a commission at LCT3 for a piece called Accounts Payable. Mm-hmm. That is it's actually sort of in flux a little bit right now because the world has sort of exceeded where the piece was. Yeah. It was set in a dystopian America.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
And it still will be, but it's like basically it's an office comedy set in the future at this ad agency in the finance department, where all these people are like jockeying for like raises and promotions, but meanwhile, like the world, America and the world is sort of like melting down outside, but they all just want like raises and promotions. So, and it's explores sort of like what it means to work 40 plus hours a week somewhere, and like what happens when like capitalism is just like totally breaking down and like crushing and grinding everybody into dust.
And which of these shows are we most likely to see first? What do you feel like is going to take off first?
If I had to place a bet, I would say White Girl in Danger, just because it's further along in its development and it has like support behind it.
Right.
I've done much more work on it recently than the others. Although Teeth is not that far behind it, but we still are looking for support for it.
Right. Yeah. How are you spending your time in lockdown these days? First of all, does lockdown make it easier to write and be creative or harder?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, it. So here's the thing. I had decided at the sort of very beginning of this that time is not of the essence and that I was not going to pressure myself into any sort of productivity because this global moment is one of looking inward and sort of like taking care of your day-to-day emotional and material needs. And so I sort of have dedicated myself mostly to that. Now, that being said, like winning the Pulitzer has forced my hand a little bit.
Yeah.
And so I now have, there's certain things I have some responsibilities to take care of, but I mostly have been spending this time just sort of like, just seeing what's going to happen because we just don't know what's going to happen. And like good or bad, we don't know what's going to happen. There's lots of like doomsday theater, Twitter people who I can't deal with that. And but and then there's also people who are like, okay, we're gonna put on a Broadway show in September, you know, like. And I just think that, like, the truth is that there's gonna probably be a third option or a fourth option, or like, just we don't know what's gonna happen. So I mostly have been just trying to just live in the uncertainty and, like, embrace it and not sort of speculate too much on what's going to happen. But I have done some writing, and, like, and as things come up, like, I'll do more.
Yeah. Do you have a sense of how this time is starting to affect the way you think creatively about your creative projects or the kinds of stories you're interested in telling, or is it too soon for something to know something like that?
Well, I'm still very much focused on the pieces that I had been working on. And so I haven't, like, yet quite thought about ahead. I will say that, like, Accounts Payable was already sort of trying to look ahead just because of the nature of its story. And this moment will probably inform that as I complete the draft, though it's not necessarily going to reference it specifically, because there's not a virus in that world. There's, like, other things. That piece is going to be more about, like, the world is going to be more breaking down because of climate change, which I think is still an issue now. It's just that our focus is less on it because of the virus. But, like, I guess, like, my feel, like, I told the Los Angeles Times that my feeling about this moment is that is that the virus has exposed all the sort of pre-existing inequities in our world, and that, and now it's like we'd walk into the kitchen late at night, turn on the lights, and found roaches on every surface. And this time, instead of the roaches skittering away, they just stare back at us defiantly. And so I'm interested in seeing theater sort of on quote unquote the other side of this, that is more directly engaging with the roaches and looking at the roaches.
Right.
Because I think that those things were here with us before. And frankly, I think, like, in the theater, like, I think the theater, the American theater has suffered a little bit from trying to be in opposition to or in resistance to Trump. And in so doing has lost some sense of self-inquiry. And so I'm hopeful for, and I hope to be a part of, looking inward and not just sort of just being a resistance playwright.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Are you interested at all in writing for the screen?
I am. You know, like, when I was in college, I definitely took my screenwriting classes and I took some television writing classes. I am interested in that. I have a film idea that I really want to write. I don't know if I'll get to it this year, but I think it's a really interesting idea that I'd be excited to write with, or maybe even co-write with, like, a director or something, just because I don't have that much screenwriting experience. And also I have, like, various television ideas. So I'm, like, beginning to dip my toe in that world. So hopefully I will be able to do that as well, in addition to my theater stuff.
Yeah. As we all sit here, missing the live experience, what have you found for you is what's really important about the live experience? Why is theater the place that you sort of do your work?
Because it's a place where we can all sit together and have a shared experience. I think that there's something equalizing about sitting in the darkness together and hearing a story that tests our empathy. And at least that's the kind of work that I like the best, and the kind of work that I endeavor to create. That for me is, like, what's missing. Like, just that we all can sit together and, like, take in a story and need it wherever we are.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to sitting together with an audience to see A Strange Loop and White Girl in Danger and everything else you're working on sometime soon, I hope. Yes. Thanks very much, Michael. Thanks for chatting with me.
Thank you so much.
That was Michael R. Jackson, the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer-composer of A Strange Loop. If you like what you're hearing on this and other episodes of Stagecraft, you can rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, and you can subscribe and find past episodes there and on all the other pod places, including Spotify and on the Broadway Podcast Network, which is a great place to find more theater for your ears. I'll be back next week with another new episode. Thanks for listening, and see you soon.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard. So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah,
not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.